for taking some time out to come out here.
I realize we're very early in a campaign, but yeah, the basic tenor of this campaign is one about getting out there, meeting the folks that we hope to represent. I am running for the House of Representatives, and that's all about, that is the House of Representatives. So the only way to do that is to go out and meet the folks that we hope to represent, the constituents. I also realize there's no way to get out and meet everyone if you don't start early. Do I have a desire to meet everyone? Absolutely. I want to meet as many folks that I hope to represent as possible. I'm not going to sit here and give you guys a lecture, and although I am a college professor.
We can handle it.
We can talk about we have a lot to talk about when it comes to healthcare. What I really want to do is take a few minutes to introduce myself and talk about why I'm on this unusual journey. And I really want to have a chance to listen to your questions, your concerns. 2 weeks ago, we walked Rancho Cordova, and we were knocking on doors in Rancho Cordova. And it's, I'm certainly coming at it from the perspective of the candidate, but people are suffering, and people are hurting. The number of homes that had lockboxes on them, it was amazing. The number of homes where a child was living with their grandparents was amazing. The number of folks that were having their cold 45 at 11 o'clock in the morning was surprising as well. And we have some difficult choices. We have some difficult decisions. So let me tell you a little bit about my background and what led me to this this point in my life. I come from an immigrant family. My parents immigrated from India in the 1950s, in search of what many in this country came to America for. We're a nation of immigrants. Opportunity and the ability to improve your life. They discovered a country that did give them that opportunity. Gave them opportunity to find meaningful work, sustainable work. It gave them an opportunity to have an educational system to put their kids in strong public schools. That dream was about climbing one or two rungs on the ladder and leaving your kids off at a better place than you started. So me and my two brothers, and I'm the youngest of three boys, started off much better than where my parents started. I had the benefit of a very strong public school system. I had the benefit of a strong community. We knew all of our neighbors. Both my parents worked first grade. I'd lock the door. I'd walk to school, say hi to all the neighbors as I was walking to school. Saturday mornings, I'd hop on my bike. We'd be off playing all day. I don't think, I knew what the rules were. I'd be home at 6 o'clock for dinner. But we were out playing. That was the community that I grew up in. We ate dinner together as a family. We watched Walter Cronkite every night on the evening news. We got our news from a single source. And I think most of America got their news from a single source. And it was news. We were informed. It wasn't entertainment. It was Walter Cronkite telling the country what was going on. So we were informed. We were engaged. I had the benefit of going to the University of California, Irvine. California had a master plan for higher education, which said any qualified student with ability was guaranteed admission. And it wasn't about whether you could afford it or not. You could pay $393 a quarter to go to medical school. And that's not that long ago. $393 a quarter. Today, students pay $27,000 a year, and they graduate about $200,000 in debt. I met my wife, we moved up here, moved up to San Francisco, did my training in internal medicine. She decided to go to medical school. That brought us up to Sacramento. She went to UC Davis, and we've been in Elk Grove for the last 15 years. This is home, of course. What worries me, though, is that I practice medicine. My first job was in the private sector of Mercy Healthcare, practicing half-time and looking at the system of care half-time. Was the number of people who were left out of the system.
the amount of redundancy and waste that occurred in the system. You know, the number of times you'd be developing a relationship with a patient, and all of a sudden their employer changed from this insurance company to that insurance company, and all of a sudden they want your patient anymore because they can't come see you. That led to leaving Mercy General when the county asked if I had interest in being medical director for Sacramento County. And I did that in the late 90s, early part of this decade. And the real desire in that job was, how do you bring people together? How do you bring four healthcare systems together to think about addressing mutual challenges? You know, the uninsured clearly was one that we had to talk about, but there are lots of issues. We had a nursing workforce shortage. The way the hospital dealt with that was, you know, they would cannibalize nurses from one system to the next system to the next system, instead of saying, wait a minute, we don't have enough nurses here. Let's figure out how to grow that supply. Let's create jobs. And we tried to push that, but there's this competitive model that exists in healthcare. I always thought the county, the whole reason county government existed was to serve the public. It was about service. What I discovered last time we went through, and what we're discovering today, is in some ways it's about preserving the institution, because they essentially cut all the services that we spent a lot of time trying to build up. When I was medical director, we had a smaller healthcare budget, but we still operated 7 public health and primary care clinics that were spread around this community. How is someone who lives up in Citrus Heights, the closest health clinic that they have today is the primary care clinic on Stockton and Broadway. Well, someone who's medically indigent, who doesn't have a car, you know how many buses they have to hop on to try to get there? It's an all-day thing, and they get there, and there's a packed waiting room. So they go without care. So that bothers me. About 6 years ago, the university asked if I had interest in being medical director. If I had interest in being dean of admissions for the medical school. That intrigued me. I always found it very curious as to these doctors that started out very passionate. They wanted to serve. I always talked to the students and pre-med students. They wanted to make a difference. And we talk about teachers who get out there and want to teach. They want to help their kids reach their full potential. But something in the system grinds them down. You're not allowed to teach. You're not allowed to practice medicine the way you want to. Nobody went to medical school. And I've interviewed hundreds of students. Nobody's ever said, well, I really want to learn whether I can take care of this person with congestive heart failure. Do they have the right card? And I can't take it. This one. Take care of yours. That's not why people go into medicine. That's not why teachers become teachers. They want to teach. Not saying, well, you can't really teach that, you've got to teach that. They want to help students reach their potential. You see that time and time again, a system that grinds people down. So why am I running? Because I think we have some real difficult issues. We have to have honest and open conversation about these issues. I live in a state that doesn't even resemble the state I grew up in. I live in a state that, when I look at the state budget, we didn't solve anything. What we did was we pushed out the problem 3 or 4 more months. Well, that's what we've been doing the last 12 years, is pushing out a problem and letting someone else. Well, I've got an 11-year-old daughter. I don't want to push it out any longer. I want to make a hard decision, and I want to have a hard conversation. We have capacity to do that. When I look at healthcare, what I'm definitely afraid of, I'm inspired by a president who's trying to have a difficult conversation. I'm disappointed by a Congress that is almost undercutting my president, that is undercutting this conversation. We've got to have this conversation. Because if we don't, we can see the train heading towards us, right? So the status quo is not an option. We know what the status quo is. Small businesses suffering from it. The auto industry is going bankrupt from it. You know, individuals, it's the number one reason for individual bankruptcy. You know, we also make up rules where the left hand or the right hand doesn't seem to know what the left hand's doing. We say all kids need to have vaccinations in order to enroll in elementary school. Well, let's cut all funding for vaccinations. Does that make any sense? What are we doing here? I got my vaccinations in school back when I was a kid. We have to get back to some very simple things. And this is not about, you know, the revenue exists. The money exists in there. Let's think about where our priorities are. I'm the beneficiary of a family that had access to the American Dream. They had the ability to find a sustainable job. They had the ability of creating security over time. My mom's an elementary school teacher. You know, I see her benefiting from having that stability. It wasn't about getting rich and wealthy. It was about security. And over time, you could actually improve your life. It was knowing that you had a job. You know, when we walked around Rancho Cordova, you saw a lot of that suffering. We are going to go through 3 to 4 years of some difficult times. And anyone who sits here and says, you know, by the fall, the economy's going to be recovering and things will be better, has not been walking around neighborhoods or talking to folks. Or at least not the neighborhoods that we're walking around. Or talking to the folks that, you know, are now going without any primary care coverage because they don't have a clinic that they can go to. They're not talking about parents who have kids in school where classes are increasing in size. Programs are being cut. They're not talking about they're not talking to parents who are trying to pay their kids college tuition. They're not talking to the 65-year-old that was thinking about getting ready to retire but now says, you know, I'm never going to retire because I can't. I could keep talking for a while. Kim's going to give me the yank here in a second. Yeah. These are not easy things to talk about, but they're conversations that we have to have. These are values that we have to rebuild. We have to rebuild the middle class. We have to rebuild the dream that you can actually climb the ladder. And if we don't rebuild that, I worry about, you know, the future of this country. If we don't find the capacity to set aside our ideology, I worry about our ability to actually come together with good ideas. You know, we have this divisiveness that's existed not my whole adult life, but just about as far as I can remember in the last 20 years, definitely, where, you know, people have lost the ability to set aside their differences to say what's best for the country. It's about winning. And they totally lose sight of the people that are suffering. And that's both parties. This can't be about gaining power. It can't be about, you know, I'm positioning myself for the next election. We have to rebuild service. That is what this is about. I don't think I'm an unusual candidate. Because I think there are people like me all across this country that realize what the country's offered us, that realize the benefits that we had, and it's our time to step up to the plate and serve. This has to be about something bigger than ourselves. I worry about the world I'm going to leave my daughter. What I see today is a world where it's going to be harder for her to go to school, it's going to be harder for her to buy that first house, it's going to be harder for her to find that sustainable career in that first job. It's going to be harder for her to decide when she can retire or even have a chance at retirement. That's not the legacy I want to leave behind. And I don't think that's the legacy most of us want to leave behind. So again, we have to have these difficult conversations. So I'll stop there before Kim gives me a little kick over here. I'm really here to listen to your concerns. Certainly feel free to ask questions. There are no bad questions. There's only the question that you want to ask and you fail to ask. I'm not going to profess to know all the answers. My job as a representative is to try, is to be accessible, is to listen, is to reflect back what I'm hearing. That is how we're going to run this campaign. It is going to be about engaging people. It is going to be about giving people voice. It is going to be about taking what we're hearing and reflecting that back. I'm not going to sit here and say we're going to solve every problem. I'd be lying to you. I'm going to sit here and say I'm going to present what I believe in and what my values are and what I intend to fight for. And that's what you should expect out of your elected officials. You should hold them accountable. You should make sure they're engaged with you. You should make sure they're present in the district, that they're giving you voice and listening to you. This is the House of Representatives. The job is to represent your concerns within the district. So, I'll stop with that. Yeah.
I would like to ask you to understand why you would want to go into politics. I'd like to know what you could do if you were elected. The only brilliance I've seen probably in the last 6 months has come from Al Franken. And I'm just so proud of him to go in and step up and say it out loud what needs to be said in terms of this Supreme Court nominee. And you would think, I mean, he's a comedian. And he just, what he did and what he said just reinforces the fact that when you don't believe you have anything to lose, you can say what needs to be said, and comedians do that all the time. And I'd like to know that the person I would work for would be willing to do the same thing.
Absolutely.
Right from the first day, no matter what you might think in terms of your career, I'd like to see it from the first day.
Because today's the first day, right? To hold me closer to that standard. Because this can't be about me. This can't be about title or position. This has to be about changing the conversation. That's what I've stood here and said. That's what you should hold me accountable to. That's what the president actually says we should be holding him accountable to. That's why Organizing for America exists. Hold him accountable. Make him have those difficult conversations. Al Franken doesn't have anything to lose, right? He's not in this because of his ego. I'm not in this for my ego. This is not the easiest decision in my life. It's never been my ambition. It's not my wife's dream. It's not financially the right thing to do. It doesn't simplify our lives in any way. But you know what? We've got to change the conversation. We have to start talking about difficult decisions. We have to start stating what's on our mind. And that's okay. I think Al Franken's going to do great. I think what we're going to discover is people are going to be drawn towards him. We've had people like that before who have started out stating the truth. It's very easy to start moderating, right? And start thinking about, okay, well, when I get reelected, etc. And that, you know, the job obviously is seductive. Hold people accountable. Don't let them get off them. So, absolutely, from day one, I have to talk about what I believe in.
Thank you.
So, you're welcome. So now someone's going to ask me a tough question.
What is it?
Well, I've opened myself up, so you should.
I've gotten here a little late, so Hopefully I'm not asking questions I've already been asked, but what are your intentions with No Child Left Behind? I'm a school teacher. I've seen the bad.
So, No Child Left Behind, in my mind, is leaving a lot of kids behind. You know, my concern with No Child Left Behind is we're teaching kids to a single standard, and we're holding them to a single standard. Not every kid's ambition or skill set or desire is that single standard. I also think it cuts out a teacher's ability to teach and innovate and go to where the student is. So, when I talked about spirit being squashed, I think a lot of teacher spirits are being squashed. But they start out enthusiastic with the desire to actually change and teach. That's what they were trained to do. And then they're told, well, here's what you got to do. Here's a curriculum. So where I stand, I think having a set of standards is important. I don't think No Child Left Behind and just this test-based curriculum is that set of standards. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that fully answers your question. I don't know I know No Child Left Behind does not work. It's leaving a lot of kids behind. We've got a 30, you know, the statistic I use is higher than the statistic, the state puts out there, but we've got a 30% high school dropout rate.
Right, the kids that can't be top-notch end up giving up so early.
Right.
Feeling like idiots at such a young age when they still have so much potential, but it's squashed.
Absolutely. So I grew up in a public school system that allowed you to, we had a broad education. You weren't made to feel them if you wanted to go into a trade. That's an honorable profession, and that's a great profession. You know, let's identify those skill sets, and let's train people to those skill sets. What I think our standard should be is, here's a basic, the floor that we think every child should, you know, have the ability to read, to do basic mathematics, to have some basic financial literacy, some basic physical education. I'm a believer in wood shop. I mean, let them know how to use a drill, the difference between screwdrivers.
In California, of course, you wouldn't be having much of that, but the standards are cut. There are so many standards in every subject, like math, sixth grade math. It's crazy. You can't really teach a kid anything because there are so many you have to cover. So you got, you know, you got 5 minutes, kid, catch this, or we're off without you. And I've seen kids' skills go up, but it's test-taking skills,
absolutely.
Not life.
So are those real life skills?
Right.
They're not. And I'm the father of a soon-to-be seventh grader here in the Upper School District, and I worry about that as well. Because we sit down and look at what she's learning when we're doing her homework, and we ask her, and she knows how to answer the question, but then we talk about, okay, well, what does that mean, and so forth, and she's not really being taught how to think.
There's no time for that.
We see that at the college level where, you know, kids are coming in and they don't have that ability to think. They have the ability to take tests, but life's not a test. I mean, when a patient rolls into our emergency room, they're not a multiple choice test, they're a person, and I've got to be able to think about it.
Right, how much of our life taking tests is a skill? I don't think there's any jobs that do that.
No.
I'm going to take a test today, tomorrow, next day. I teach special ed, and I'm lucky because I can teach at depth. And I watch my kids whose ability is supposedly so much lower than other kids, and we can go to places that the other kids never get the opportunity to go to because they're being rushed along and rolled along and don't even get to really know what they're doing.
So. Well, along those lines, Ami, and obviously with Ashley being a little over a year, almost 2 years old, you know, my concerns in the next couple of years are, I live in Elk Grove, and I'm going to be putting her into a preschool or in public schools, and obviously, you know, the experience that we've been having with classroom sizes are getting larger, and teachers are worried about keeping their jobs, and so they're looking and they're not concentrating on teaching our kids, and we can't afford to put her in a private school. So I guess my question to you would be, what makes you different than all the other candidates out there, and what are you going to do to promote what you've engaged in our community?
So the reason why we moved here was a strong public school system. The reason why a lot of families move to Elk Grove in this community is because of the school system. That school system is being undermined. It's about looking at the resources that we have and saying, what are our priorities? And our priorities have to be about building into the next generation. They can't be consuming today. That's never historically been our value set. The last 20 years probably has been our value set. How do we get ours, and how do we get ours now? So, in many ways, we've been squandering that future. So, you know, the three things I obviously run on are healthcare, education, and creating sustainable jobs, a sustainable workforce, a sustainable pathway. Answering your question, some of that is giving schools back to teachers. Some of that is, you know, at the federal level, you have the ability to provide resources. But I don't think the federal level should be setting the standards. I think those are actually best set at the school district level because each district is a little bit different. You can set broad standards to say, you know, here's the floor that we think every student should be achieving towards. But but not the ceiling, because every student's not going towards college. I'm also a strong believer in creating systems that encourage parents to be involved in the schools, because then the schools are held accountable. Parents are not involved in the schools. Our daughter went to Phelps Ranch, which had a very high parental involvement rate and a very active parent-teacher organization. And I think that does drive things. That then helps hold teachers accountable.
With that in mind, are you planning to try to implement programs in schools to involve parents, or?
Yeah, I think about it. It's not a simple thing to do because everyone's working harder. Many parents are working two jobs. But I think if we can't get them back involved in their kids' lives, in their schools, sitting down doing homework, there's some simple ideas that you hear about. One idea is actually in lower performing schools, in the summertime, having the teacher go out and at least make a phone call or do a home visit with the students that they're going to teach. So there's a relationship established. So then if little Johnny in the middle of the school year is struggling, when the phone call's made, it's, hi, this is Mrs. Smith, and we met over the summertime. I think that's a simple intervention. It is empowering teachers. It is building community and relationship. I don't think that exists right now in most school districts. It's a simple idea. That's not about cost. That's about rebuilding community and getting parents engaged.
Sorry to be a question.
Did I answer your question?
Yeah.
I mean, the classroom size one is, they're just looking at resources and dollars and cents and saying, how do we balance the budget? Not necessarily saying, okay, the first thing that we have to do is teach the kids. What's the most effective way for us to teach the kids? Now what resources do we have available, and how do we fit those resources into the service we're supposed to be providing?
It kind of goes along with her question. At a federal level, of course, you're not going to have, as far as the actual programs, not much impact that you can make. But what about things like fully funding special education in Title I? What are your thoughts on that?
So I have to be honest, it's not one that I fully thought through and so forth.
Because the federal government really doesn't, doesn't have a lot of hands-on to education other than the No Child Left Behind. But we're told to do a job and we're not given any money to do it, and we're required to have special ed, which is good, but the federal government has never fully funded it as they promised to do, and
as they do with a lot of things.
Yeah.
Saying, okay, well, let's set the standard here, but we're not going to give you the resources to meet that standard. Mm-hmm.
So it would be nice if you maybe check that out.
That's absolutely.
And that might help a lot at the local level. I know that special ed impinges a lot on the general fund. It takes money out of the classroom and makes it an annoyance to many administrators rather than something that's a blessing because of that.
Again, so you touch on something, and Kim, you alluded to something, which was, how do we lead by looking at what we're trying to accomplish? And when I think of schools, when I think of governments, when I think of healthcare, it's about service, which is what we should be leading toward. So we're talking about schools, so let's stick there. The service component there is, how do we best teach the children that we're supposed to be teaching, whether it's special education kids or kids in a traditional classroom. That's where we should have the decision point. The resources are the resources, so we should then take the resources and say, okay, this is how much of the pie we have. How do we use those resources to best meet this need to serve? What's happening today is a subtle shift, but it's a huge shift. It's about how do we protect the institution first, and then once the institution is saved, now what kind of service can we provide? That is a big difference. Because again, schools only exist to teach kids. Government exists to serve the population, whether it's local government, etc. So again, before I leave that, we should lead by service first. We should say, this is, so the county exists to take care of the residents of this community. The federal government exists to take care of Americans. So we should think about service. The schools exist to teach the kids. So think about that service component. And then, yes, the resources are going to grow and shrink. But look at the resources that you have then and say, okay, what's the best way for us to meet that service mission? Instead of saying, how do we protect the institution first? And then say, okay, what kind of service can we do? And that's where classroom size increases. If it's been shown the best way to teach kids are at a certain classroom size, well, then say, that's what's best for the kids. Well, here's the resources we have. How do we best achieve that? And it may be that then you say, okay, well, you know, we've got to go out to the parents and help them, you know, fill in some of the gaps, or we've got to change, you know, some of the administrative jobs have to shift and put people back in the classroom. So, does that make sense? Because I think that's a really important component. And that probably is applicable all across the board. So.
You know, Republicans and the Blue Dogs are really using a lot of fear tactics and, you know, distortions and lies, frankly lies, to really scare a lot of the American citizens about health care right now and health insurance. And even going so far as to telling, you know, the elderly population that, you know, the government's going to kill them. Representative Fox was using that in Congress. So, you know, Dan Lundgren, he's going to be having his town hall pretty soon. He's sent out, I've got my telephone calls from him, the phone town halls. Just got an email from him yesterday or today, which I answered. And, you know, color groceries, the whole thing, you know. And in the last town hall, you know, it was very moderated. You couldn't ask the questions directly. And, you know, he flat out, you know, distorts the truth. You know, when you ask him a factual question, you know, stating that, you know, we're 37, you know, in the healthcare delivery with the World Health Organization, completely denies that that's the truth. You know, states that, you know, the Saudi Arabians come over here for their health care, you know, just things that are just absolutely not true. So what is your...
Well, Saudi Arabians can afford Cadillac healthcare, so...
So what is your career strategy going to be to address those lies with Dan Lundgren and...
Dan Lundgren's not walking the neighborhoods that we're walking. He's not talking to the folks that we're talking to. He's living in a very isolated community, right? He's surrounded by a very isolated perspective on the world, so...
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't take but to open your eyes to see what's going on out there where people are suffering. Mm-hmm. You touched on the politics of fear.
Yeah.
That's the politics that have been played out for, you know, who knows how long. Are we going to be so afraid that we hold on to the piece of driftwood that's shrinking and shrinking until we drown? Or are we going to choose to let go and swim over to something better? We know the healthcare system we have doesn't work. We know that 50 million, you know, so they're going to say, well, they're going to ration healthcare. Let's go talk to the 50 million people who don't have any healthcare. They're going to tell you we're rationing already. So what happened to compassion? What happened to, and you know, Dan Lundgren is going to try to present himself as a very compassionate person. And what happened to compassion? What happened to the golden rule? What happened to looking after your neighbor? This isn't about, you know, Cadillac service. This is about saying, here as Americans, as the wealthiest country in the world, this is what everybody deserves. Nobody's going to sit here and argue, or Dan Lundgren may argue, since he had children's health care, that kids shouldn't have access to vaccinations. Nobody is going to sit here, nobody who thinks rationally is going to argue that if a woman feels a breast lump, she shouldn't be able to go in to a doctor or go get a mammogram and get an assessment. No one is going to sit here and argue that if I'm in the middle of chemotherapy and I lose my job, I should have to sit here and struggle and think about, okay, what am I going to do? Am I going to pay $1,000 for POBRA? Am I going to, if, you know, if that's even accessible to me, am I going to pay my mortgage payment? Am I going to, let's put some compassion back in to the system. Let's think about what we're doing.
But Democrats are so bad at framing a message. Instead of framing that as an American value, they, you know, Luntz does it so well, and we have not been able to do that. And we call it health care reform, we should be calling it health insurance reform. You know, we should be telling people that Medicare really is socialized insurance, the VA is socialized medicine.
Let's stay away from the word socialized.
But even still, because
so what I would say is, as Americans, what is that for, that standard? Healthcare as a for-profit industry makes no sense, right? We're not going to privatize and make the police department for-profit. We're not going to privatize and make the fire department for-profit. Healthcare is the same thing. I mean, that's a basic right. I mean, if you don't have access to those basic rights, well, that's a problem. That's what government exists for, is to ensure that here is the basic necessities that every American has access to. Every child has access to a school that actually teaches them something. And every adult, every American should have access to basic health care. It's a difficult conversation, but we have to have that conversation because we see the train coming down the tracks at us, right? So how I would characterize this vote is, you know, it is about insurance reform, right? And it's not about necessarily a government-delivered healthcare system. But it is about moving to a not-for-profit healthcare system. Because if you're looking at a for-profit healthcare system, well, how do insurance companies make money in a for-profit system? They deny service. They limit it. They enrich your shareholders. That isn't healthcare. That's not what I want. I don't think that's what most Americans want. I think what they want is, if I'm sick, do I know there's someplace that I can go? If I lose my job, then do I know that I'm not going to lose my access to health, to medicine?
So what would be your response when somebody says that you're putting the government between me and my doctor, and that by even having the government oversee a private insurance company, which you're talking about, that's putting the government between me and my doctor. You're determining how do you articulate the argument to win this? Because I feel like we're starting to lose this battle.
So what I would say is, I never once said that. What I said was, the government needs to create a standard that says this is what every American has access to. And let's figure out what that standard is. And the only reason we talk about healthcare right now is because the cost is going through the roof, bankrupting this country. So let's figure out, you know, that dollar amount. For sake of discussion, we spend $8,000 per American on healthcare, $2.4 billion. Let's just say we cut that in half and say, okay, let's buy everyone a $4,000 health insurance policy. That's $1.2 million. $4,000 health insurance policy for every American is a pretty good policy. Let's start out and say, well, what would that cover? What kind of benefits would we want to put into that policy? And we can then also graduate that based on age. We have all that data. It all exists. And we also know that, you know, the 16-year-old doesn't only need $4,000 for care, but that's offsetting the cost of the 75-year-old for 17-year-old. So it's all there. That's what the rest of the world does. So what I would say is government can set that. That's what this benefit looks like. The private sector may be the most efficient way to deliver that care. I would look at Kaiser and say, okay, well, you know what, you're going to take these 1,000 lives, and we'll just use Kaiser as an example. It could be any number of not-for-profit places. You're taking care of these million lives. Here's your payment of $4 billion up front. Now their incentive is to deliver that care. Government's goal is to say, well, here's what has to be covered, and we're going to monitor that care. We're going to look at quality outcomes, we're going to look at mammogram rates, we're going to look at colonoscopy rates, cancer screening rates, cholesterol. right? So we're going to look at time from when you pick up the phone to call for an appointment and time you actually get an appointment. We do a lot of that already. A lot of that system is already built. That is government's role, which is to say, okay, well, we're entering into a contract with such and such insurance company. The insurance companies probably are a reasonably efficient way to deliver that service. If this is a not-for-profit industry. Now, if they deliver the care at $3,500, well, they've got $500 there that they can put back into patient care.
But that's intellectual response. What's the
15-second time? The 15-second
professor,
I'm a college
professor.
So the problem is we live in a soundbite world.
Yeah, exactly.
And these are difficult challenges that we have to think through. So a soundbite works when you're trying to scare someone.
That's right. But you're on TV and you've got to respond to that. You've got to be able to say, well, you know, insurance companies are now right in between you and your doctor.
Absolutely.
You know,
well, there's the soundbite. We don't want to lose track of the fact that Obama's winning by articulating arguments the way that they're doing.
Right, yeah. So that's, you know, but in the single year...
What value is the insurance company providing you?
That's right. I know what doctors provide, I know what services.
Right.
Nurses provide, what health companies provide.
All we're talking about is the government providing the funding source. Mm-hmm. We're not talking about socialized medicine. We're talking about the government providing the funding source. So if you move from California to Nevada, your health insurance moves with you.
Perfect.
If you move from job A to job B, your health insurance moves with you. If you got a chance to advance your life, your health insurance moves with you.
Your company goes out of business, and you don't have access to COBRA anymore because there is no insurance plan.
Your health insurance stays with
you. That would be nice. Could you get that done by September?
You got to recall down language.
The model already exists.
Okay.
That model exists within the Indian Health Service. It exists within the VA.
Yeah, that's exactly
so right. There is proof that the government can do that and do that.
Absolutely.
You know, with quality indicators in place. And
but people don't know that. They don't know that about
right.
VA.
Because they're the fear.
That's right.
Right?
Yeah.
So if you make people afraid, they'll never enter into the conversation until the system just falls apart. Right? That is the difficult conversation.
I have a question for a reporter.
I'm just wondering on how you would change Medicare and Medi-Cal then.
So what you'd probably have to do is take the funding that's in those systems and put them into this system. But again, you're talking about everyone having the same coverage.
So whether or not they have a job or don't have a job or
an employer-based
homeless or not homeless.
Absolutely. Every American should have basic coverage. Now, that doesn't prevent someone from saying, okay, well, I have my discretionary income. I want to buy a richer policy. That's fine. I can live with that.
So would the policy come down to where Medi-Cal and Medicare is, or would that be now the standard?
Isn't the ideal situation expanded Medicare for all, single payer? Isn't that the ideal? I suppose.
Yeah, but I want
to... You want to hear my answer? It's not bringing it down to Medi-Cal. It is probably, again, the whole reason we're talking about healthcare is because the cost is going through the roof, right?
Right.
Business can't afford it. Individuals can't afford it. Nobody, government can't afford it. So that we do have to start there and say, okay, well, what do we want to spend on healthcare? And let's say, you know, we're Americans. We like to have the best. So, yeah, the next highest country, I think, is the Netherlands, and they spend like 12.9% of GDP. We're at 17 going on 18. So let's say we want to spend 14% of our GDP on healthcare. You know, then we can sit down and work backwards and say, how much money is that? And then we can say, what will that allow us to cover? And then we can say, let's now set the standard to say, here's how much money we have per American based on ACT. I'm giving that college professorial answer. But this is a difficult conversation. conversation and it doesn't lend itself to a soundbite, then you can work backwards and say, within this context, what can we pepper? And so to just, for me to give a soundbite and say, well, we're going to raise everyone to the Medicare standard, I don't know that to be a fact. It may be higher than the Medicare standard. It probably is higher than the Medi-Cal standard.
The reason I asked it in that way was to hear what you would say, because I actually know some people who are on Medicare and Medi-Cal that get better care than people on higher insurance. And so I just wanted to see what you were, where you were coming from.
You know, I think that you used the term a difficult conversation. And to his point, I really don't think it's a difficult conversation. It's a conversation instead of a soundbite. So I think that when you talk about what you want to, when we talk about what we want to hear from you, we want a conversation. That's why Barack Obama's president, because he talked to us like we were intelligent and that we could discern maybe some terms that we weren't used to hearing, but they weren't so complex we couldn't access it. So I think that just using the term conversation instead of difficult, I think sounds better to me from someone I would want to get behind.
These are conversations that we have to have.
There you go. Right.
Conversations that we have to have. If we want to rebuild our country.
I've participated in negotiations with medical insurers in the teachers union, and one of the things that they're always going up and down about is the power of being in a pool, a large pool of people. And I teach in Galt, that's a small district, so oh, you're just a small district, you know, you're not a big enough pool, so we're going to charge you up for your insurance. And a big deal hasn't been made about the fact that if you get everybody in it together, we're a large pool, and that should bring down the prices. But I don't hear that being
remember,
said.
Remember, the pool concept is a for-profit concept that says, okay, well, I want to make money on this insurance product. So if everybody's covered, well, then the pool's tossed out, right? It doesn't exist any longer. Everyone has coverage.
I'm just curious why it is that every company in America that provides health care insurance to their employees is not for a public option.
I'm curious about that as well. And you know what? Increasingly, small business wants to give up health care. So if we come up with a Massachusetts-type system, and I'm definitely afraid that we'll end up in that type of a system, which I think is politically flawed, because it still ties it to the employer-based system. What's going to happen is, and this is what happened in Massachusetts, and should I back up and just give a 30-second answer on the Massachusetts system? What it is an employer-based system that's tied to a subsidy and looking at small business, saying lower-income individuals, the state will subsidize more of their health care. But, like auto insurance, there's an individual mandate. Everybody has to have health insurance. So businesses can either provide that health insurance to their employees, or if they choose not to, they can pay into a pool. Well, Massachusetts, so on paper it sounds very elegant. They did, since there's an individual mandate, they have covered those. But what happened was every business sat there and said, okay, well, I could just pay into this pool, it becomes a fixed cost for me. So they just dropped their coverage and entered into the pool. That's what I would do as a business owner. If I was looking at healthcare expenses that were going up 10% every year, I'd say, okay, well, let me just make it a fixed cost. They didn't take that into account. So, you know, people were just paying into the pool. So the state didn't budget how much they would actually have to be spending. That's what's going to happen if we do this. And again, we'll be right back at the table. And what I'm definitely afraid of is 4 years from now, if the cost continues to rise, the Republicans are going to sit there and say, told you so.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And we can't allow that to happen. Because this is our single best shot of changing this and coming up with something that's comprehensive and compassionate. This is our best shot. We can't compromise on this. And we have to give the president the strength not to compromise on this. Right? That has to come from all of us. That has to come from, you know, there's going to be these town hall meetings. There's going to be the no tax folks coming out there, you know, doing it. We've got to make our voice loud and heard. And we're going to be having a healthcare town hall, aren't we?
We are.
What is the
longer
meeting?
August 26th.
At the Rancho Cordova City Hall.
Thank you.
At 6:30.
What kind of a representative is that? It's taking you off the list. How can you represent your opinion? How can you represent your opinion? That just means he doesn't want people who have an opposite viewpoint. How can you govern that way? Right?
It'll be on the website.
So if I'm wrong, people that don't know.
Thank you.
Rancho Cordova.
Rancho Cordova City Hall.
Bring the questions that you have.
Are you going, did you say you were going to be there?
I said we probably will very closely around that time have our own healthcare town hall.
Is that not the thing to do for political etiquette?
It is good to talk to his constituents and just what you're talking to.
Yeah.
So, my question.
Yeah. The questions you're asking me, he should be able to answer. And he should invite you to ask the questions. It should be a controlled setting. Right?
Right.
He also should, so one thing I will promise and hold me to this, you can't take people off the list if you're going to represent them just because they may disagree with you. In fact, those are the conversations you should be engaging in. Because if you just surround yourself with people that agree with you, you're only going to look at the world from one perspective, and you're going to think we have the best healthcare system in the world and everyone has coverage. They're just too lazy to go out and get that coverage, right? Because you're looking at the world like this. Let's expand Dan Lindbergh's viewpoint. In fact, let's get him out of here.
Okay.
Sorry, Eddie. Don't book that.
You opened the door for me to ask this.
Please.
So it's very straightforward, but it's also pragmatic, and I think it follows up with some of the other things, and that is, you know, given our current state of unacceptable representation, can you win?
Absolutely.
Do you have the internal and the external resources to be a career politician, particularly now?
To be a career politician. You didn't say to be a career politician, because
be
I have no ambition to be a career politician. I have ambition to beat a career politician, because a career politician's out of touch. He's not representing anyone other than his own interests.
Yeah.
Right? So, absolutely. You know, we have the resources, and we'll raise the resources. We outraised Dan Lindgren by $50,000 in this last quarter. And we'll continue to keep that key on. People are tired of the sort of politician that doesn't represent them. If there was ever one election where it paid not to be a career politician, that's this one, where it paid to be a doctor who actually is taking care of people, who actually has been at the bedside, and Bill Gerson was one of those politicians as well, who's actually listened to people's struggles. That's this election. If there was ever an election where it was the right election for someone who spent a lot of their lifetime in public service, that's this election. Public service, and as I'm interpreting it, is out in the field, working with people, talking to people. We're going to work harder. We're going to raise more money. We're going to have a mobilized population. We saw something amazing happen in 2008. And I'm talking about our presidential election. And think about it. 2 weeks ago, at the 100th anniversary of the NAACP, you had an African-American president delivering the address to the NAACP. 2 years ago, when we all started working on the campaign, people thought we were nuts.
Mm-hmm.
Like, well, 2.5 years. I started today. We started a couple months earlier. But when I started making those first phone calls, everybody said, are you crazy? And he's a nice guy. He gives a good speech. He's got passion. He's not going to win. He outworked his opponents both in the primary and in the general election. He talked to people. We heard you guys say, he talked to us. He treated us as though we had opinions, and he still does. He treated us as though our opinions actually matter. So he was in this, and he's representing us the same way. He's engaging in conversation. He's communicating. He's out there in public every day. This isn't about closing doors, surrounding yourself in an insulated way. This is about being out there. So that's how we're going to win, is we're going to engage the population. We have to touch as many lives as possible. We have to empower people who no longer feel empowered, who feel like they don't have a seat at the table. We have to make people think that this is their district and this is their country and they can take it back, that they can make the schools that they want be the schools that they want. They can hold those things accountable, that they can try to get the resources for the kids that they want to teach. We have to take this country back. You know, today, Citibank gave out over $4 billion of bonuses, or that came out in 2008, they gave over $4 billion of bonuses. What is that all about? Seriously, what is that all about? Have we lost our mind? Seriously, have we lost our mind? My own institution, UC Davis, hires a brand new chancellor, gives her a 25 to 30% raise, gives her a $100,000 moving allowance. She has subsidized housing. In the same month, they jack up student tuition, they cut enrollment. Have we lost our mind? And the only thing they can say is, well, we've got to pay a competitive wage. She may be the most wonderful chancellor in the world, but this is about service. That's a public institution. Government is a public institution. It's not a place where you go to get wealthy. It's a place where you go to get to serve, to make an improvement in your community. It never was. So, sorry.
I'd be negligent as a campaign coordinator not to say this. AMI has our raise deadline. We're now raising about $50,000. That's over this last quarter. Dan Lindgren took, during that time period, AMI took $0 from PACs. Zero. Dan Lindgren took $150,000 plus.
Harry, what PACs did he take money from?
He took $12,000 from insurance PACs during the middle of the biggest healthcare crisis.
Did you send that to us in an email before this meeting on the 20th? So we did that.
Well, hopefully by that time, I will have a career total for you. But this is just for since January, which is basically...
He also took pharmaceutical industry money.
He has a lot of money from pharmaceuticals, and he has a lot of money from defense industry. That's basically that most of his PAC money is
so... So there's a reason. So how can you govern? I mean, that compromises your ability to look at the world effectively. I, as a doctor, operate under rules and regulations that state conflict of interest. How is that not a conflict of interest? Seriously, how do we allow that to happen in America, in this state, in the country, on a daily basis? He can't. You know, if he's taking money from insurance, how can he govern insurance? If he's taking money from the pharmaceutical industry, how can he govern the pharmaceutical industry?
But I've always wondered how the Republican viewpoint is that government is bad and that service to community is socialism, and how can you govern with those ideas in your mind to begin with? That's kind of where I come from.
Yeah, I'm confused as well. You know, they're looking at the world through a very narrow viewpoint, right?
Do you have any emails you sent to Robert that would embarrass us if we supported you?
No, we had about five of us to look at them beforehand.
We went to Argentina.
Yeah, well,
or on the Appalachian Trail.
Exactly. Saying you've been there. Please don't embarrass us.
Eventually, going to electability, one of the things that I came home with, I didn't want to do another candidate campaign.
That's what you said.
I was done. And I met him, and that was it. And one of the first things I did is hire a researcher and look at this guy. This guy's jaded. He's done this for 20 years. And he's like, Dr. Barra's like really great. He's like the nicest guy. I can't find anything. I'm like, okay, this is why I'm here.
I haven't talked to my wife yet. Joking, tongue in cheek.
I have.
No.
Your wife is a millennial.
You're at your town hall, healthcare town hall meeting, and we all know that they, right now, on our side, there's the new Harry and Louise commercial out there that's promoting healthcare reform. And now there's George and Gracie.
Is there George and Gracie?
Okay, who were saying that, I don't know what their names are, but they're the guy saying, oh my God, they won't pay for my insurance.
Right.
And Gracie is saying, oh, but they'll pay for abortions. You can't live like this. And what, when somebody stands up in that town hall and presents that to you, how do you respond to them?
Look, they're scaring you, saying you're dying. People are dying every day because they have no coverage. So we're not talking in hypothetical terms about what's going to happen. We know every day people are dying. Because they can't take care. They can't get their cancer treated. They wait to present to the emergency room and their cancer is already full blown. We know that. Go talk to your neighbors. Because we know that plays every day. So let's not think in hypothetical. We know this is what's happening today. Right? So people are dying. People are going without coverage, et cetera. You know, let's fix it. Is that fair?
Yeah, that's good. Okay. I wanted to hear that. 30-second
sound bite.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I didn't know this was a training session.
just bringing it back to your question. I wouldn't do this if I didn't think I was going to win this election. And I can only win this election with the help of everyone, because we are going against a career politician that knows every trick in the book and is going to use every trick in the book, because he can't win otherwise. Mm-hmm. Right? Everybody who voted in the Obama campaign needs to get out there and vote in this 2010 election. Even if they're disgusted with what government is doing, the only way, this is a participatory democracy, the only way to change this is by participating. Barack Obama won the district, got over 50% of the vote. We know the voter registration's changed. It's 40% Republican, 38% Democrat, and with Kim's effort, in all of our efforts, it's going to be 45% Democrat, and we're going to take those votes from the Republican ranks. We're going to get out there, and we're going to make sure people are registered to vote. In our conversation the other night, we're going to go to districts that people largely ignore, populations that people ignore. We have to, because that's the only way they're going to change and bring resources and bring attention to their suffering. That's also the only way I'm going to hear what's going on, and we're all going to get it done. So we have to give voice to those individuals. We also have to go to the foothills and engage the foothills and so forth. Allison Huber is not a career politician, yet she won the 10th Assembly District. Why? She worked hard. She talked to people. She engaged the population she was running with. She went to populations that are largely ignored. This is my full-time job now. I took a leave of absence June 30th. This is what I have to do day in and day out. Meet folks, get them engaged, get them to believe that we actually can rebuild this district. So, I'm sorry.
Two of the things I keep hearing from my conservative relations is that, our taxes are gonna kill us, like our health insurance conversation, and that, they're going to spend all the money on immigrants instead of Americans. And those are crazy arguments, but those are the ones I keep hearing. What's a good answer to that one?
You know, what I'd first say is that's the first strategy that's always tossed out there. They're going to just tax us to death. Let's take a look at the resources that we already have available. Let's look at where those resources are going. And then let's start there. Now, this may be about shared sacrifice. It may be about everyone giving a little bit. My generation has never really been asked to sacrifice anything. When you talk to folks who lived and grew up in the World War II generation, they understood what shared sacrifice was, what shared compromise was, about being part of something bigger than yourself. The Vietnam War generation even was engaged, right? They had skin in the game. If I go to a war protest today, I don't see many people my age, and definitely I don't see anyone younger than me. I mean, you see a few folks, but you see a lot of folks who are in their 60s who had protested the Vietnam War. So, bringing it back, I think it's okay. I'm affluent. I have ability. If part of my sacrifice is putting a little bit more into the system, that's fine.
But you're not going to get a lot of people that are like you, Ami.
you know what, we have to think about ourselves as being part of something bigger than ourselves. Because if we just hold on to what little we have, you know, a lot of people are going to suffer in silence and by themselves. So we could either come together and sacrifice a little bit together and rebuild our communities. And those folks that don't want to do that, they're impacted by all this as well. Because what happens to the uninsured folks that don't have access to care? They end up going to the emergency room. So you may have the best health insurance, but this emergency room now is overcrowded. So you get spun around instead of getting taken to, you know, Kaiser South or Mercy Methodist. You may get taken to Sutter Roseville because all the ERs are all packed and backed up. And that might be the time between getting you treatment for your heart attack and not making it in time. So it does impact all of us. Don't let the people who say, well, I don't want to pay for their health care. They're already paying for their health care. Everybody who has insurance pays about $1,000 towards covering the cost of the uninsured. So it's there, right? We're already paying for all of this. Let's just do it in a rational way. I'd start by saying let's cover all Americans, and then let's figure out how to cover everyone else. You know, that's because if we start on the periphery and say that we've got to do that first, we're never going to advance the conversation. So let's start by making sure every American has access to basic, core, compassionate services, whether that's school. You know, it pains me to think that families sleep in their cars today. I mean, you should just have basic access to shelter. It pains me to think about the number of kids that go hungry every night. You should have basic access to just basic sustenance. We're not talking about anything other than what's compassionate. That's it. Let's start there. But as a, you know, as a compassionate country, that's where we want to start. Does that make sense? I mean, that's where I would shift the conversation.
I really like you bringing values in that haven't been talked about in a long time. And there's a shift in consciousness that's just going on. And why not put politics in with a shift in consciousness?
Absolutely.
I think it's terrific.
So the public is always ahead of the politicians, right?
Yeah.
People are saving at the highest rate they've saved in 15 years. Families are eating dinner together again. We're starting to see multi-generational families coming back into vote. Yes, it's a bit out of necessity. Rather seeing kids moving in with parents or parents moving in with kids. Those aren't bad things, though. Those are traditional American values.
Mm-hmm.
You know, national park reservations last year went up 15%, and they've continued to go up this year. You know, that's how we vacation.
Yeah.
We went camping.
Yeah.
Didn't cost an arm and a leg. That's not a bad thing. Back in those days, the tents weren't quite as easy, so it was a test of my dad's patience trying to figure out which poles were what. So it's a little bit simpler today.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what I'm talking about. Yes. You're the next generation, by the way.
Yeah. I had a question about like the ignored areas, how like you're reaching out to other places. Where I live, it's largely ignored. It's like, oh, I don't call them like near Grantline. And like most of people think that it's mostly conservative, but most of them are liberal. And they wanted to get involved like, with the environmental campaign, but they never got any contact. And so I think if we reached out to those people, we'd get more involvement.
Absolutely. So you're going to talk to Ken Mack.
Yeah, Ken's going to have you.
You're
going to be walking that area.
You're going to be a champion of your neighborhood, because some of this is also block by block. And I'm going to sit here and say, yes, strategically, we're going to want to go talk to Democratic neighborhoods, to climate state neighborhoods, but I also want to engage in the conversation with those that are registered as Republicans.
Absolutely.
Because the values that we're talking about are not Democratic values or Republican values, they're American values,
mm-hmm.
right? Hard work, opportunity, giving people a chance, strong schools, strong public education, strong communities, youth sports, families, so.
You know, on Tuesday, isn't there like a National Neighborhood Day on Tuesday?
It's a lot
National
of people.
Yeah. I should probably take some of those.
It's your president's birthday on Tuesday.
Is it?
Yeah.
Isn't that funny? It's National Night Out. Wow.
It's day after my birthday. I didn't know that.
There you go. It all comes together. It's a harmonic
convention. Is it National Community Night Out?
It is.
Easy on your head.
So I wonder, like my neighborhood's already doing something at our park. I should probably have some things to share with them.
Yes, you should.
And should I, where should I get them from?
Talk to me before you leave.
I will.
My neighborhood is awful.
Right, I got you.
Tommy? I think an immediate strategy for your campaign, or actually for any Democratic campaign right now, is, you know, on the grassroots level, especially from the Democratic Party, Democrats, they are pretty angry right now about health care and what's going on in Washington with the Senate. And I think they're angry with Obama as well. And they feel like he's not coming out strong enough. You know, he was very passionate during the campaign about public option, and lately that's been
waning. It's getting moderated.
Yeah, and then coming out as co-ops and other things. And so I think what you know, when you talk about OFA, I think really if there's a lot of Obama people I've talked to, there's a lot of Democrats that I've talked to. PDA folks, DFA folks, all across the country, on conference calls, everything, that, you know, if this does not go through, a public option does not go through, because really they've compromised from coming down from single payer down to this public option, and if that does not go through, we're going to lose a lot of Obama people, we're going to lose a lot of Democrats who are not going to come out and vote in the next election. They're not going to come out and work. And so we need to activate these people now to put as much pressure as we can on Obama, on our Senate, on our House of Representatives in the next few weeks.
They're all back in district. Right?
That's right. To get them to make sure that we come up with a public option. If we can get the public option through, it will make the campaigns that are coming up much easier. Much easier to come up with some wins.
And I wonder if promotion wouldn't be much better if that was an extremely well-defined public option, so that instead of, one of the things that's made me uncomfortable recently is, let's promote Obama's health plan. Well, what are we trying to promote? I've been uncomfortable about getting involved in a campaign that starts with something obscure, rather than something specific. I can get behind something specific.
Because his health plan's changing, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I'm concerned about that, because I'm hearing people actually, you know, saying, this is it. If public option doesn't go through, I'm done. I'm not going to work on any campaigns. I'm not, you know. So it's you know, I'm really concerned for these campaigns, for Allison's campaign, for Joan's campaign, for your campaign, for all these things that are coming up. We need to get to work now.
And that's the danger. You know, voting rates have been going down, right? The last presidential election was an anomaly, because people turned out. And I just thought, you know, why is it that people don't vote? Especially in this country. You know, and you look at other democratic countries across the world, and you have much higher turnout voting.
Yeah.
And I think it's because people don't feel like anyone's listening, right? So.
And this may be, in this state, maybe the opportune time, if we can do that work and make sure that public option happens, with the way services have been cut in this state,
right,
those vulnerable people are looking for somebody to be their voice, because right now in this state they don't have one. So I'm sorry, that's my question. That's why I'm kind of sitting here, because I could be on the soapbox too.
Well, so what I absolutely agree with you. Mm-hmm. How do we keep the pressure on? How do we give voice? How do we give strength? Because I do think the president does want to address this and fix this in a proactive way.
Mm-hmm.
I do think he's being undermined.
Absolutely.
And I do believe he told us we need to hold him accountable. Mm-hmm. Much as he said, we need to hold him accountable. And that then gives him strength.
But we're not in Washington voting. And when they come home during August, during their August break, I mean, if we go out and we tell them that we want this public option, absent a single, and they go back and lie and say we didn't say that.
Well, then, then what I would do is your representative is holding a town hall meeting, and I'd turn out as many of his constituents to let him know this is what his constituents wanted to vote for.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Every day, mm-hmm. I've been calling. I wrote Feinstein today. I wrote Feinstein today. I mean, you know, start, get on that list and call every blue dog you can.
If it's your concern, and just speaking as an activist, then the people, not only the people that you're concerned about, but the people that I think are going to be with you. So we've got two senators in the state, and they often mm-hmm. vote differently.
Mm-hmm.
The one that you think may be with you, you should give her some props.
Oh, absolutely.
Thank
yeah,
you very much for
yeah.
being with and
yeah.
don't neglect that because,
that's true.
I mean, in the beginning we call it political cover, but it's basically saying, we got
we're
your back.
Yeah, we're with you.
And,
yeah.
that's important mm-hmm. to not only just harp on the people who are losing the faith,
absolutely.
But to go the other way too. Because I've been inside that office and you're getting all the angry phone calls from the Rush Limbaugh people. But when you get those 4, 5, 10 calls from your students saying, way to go, thanks for coming for me, it makes a big difference.
Mm-hmm. That's right. That's
true. Yeah, I want to ask you one question that we actually haven't talked about. And I share everybody's concern about education and health care. But I have a son sitting in Iraq right now. And that's an issue that's gone forgotten. It's been forgotten. And I know that our president is committed to drawing the troops down. I know that he's talking about getting the majority of about in 2011. But I'd like to know where you stand and what kind of, how are you going to hold him to that?
So first off, we should applaud the troops. When I talk, those that are serving and the families, those that are serving actually have made a sacrifice. They actually have skin in the game. Second, the troops have accomplished every goal that was put out in front of them. So at this juncture, I don't know what the goal is. What are they doing in Iraq? So it is time to come home. Does anyone in this room know what the goal is? What is the articulated goal? Was it to have a democratic free election? Well, they have that. Was it to help stop them? Well, they accomplished that. It was never to occupy a country. So again, I understand that unfortunately we broke a country. But they don't want us in their house any longer either. And you'd much rather live in your own house and deal with your own problems than have someone there who's perpetuating those problems. I think the sooner we get out, the better. You didn't mention Afghanistan, but we should talk about that as well, because that's a related issue. I don't know what the goal is there either. And I don't know that they want us there. I think they're afraid of our in a different way than their Iraqi people, because they did live under a pretty tyrannical rule. I do think there's a vacuum of trust behind that. I would prefer that they shift less from a military pressure, more to a rebuilding pressure, because I think that's really what they're asking us for, a rebuilding school. Plus, time and time again, it has been shown you build schools when you build infrastructure, et cetera, you build big wealth. That's what I would focus on. Now let's continue going south. Pakistan is what I really worry about, because we have an Indian country that is imploding. And I'm worried that that's a client of our failed foreign policy. Right? Because we, time and time again, we can look at the South Iran. You can look at supporting Iraq. You can look at Manuel Noriega. We have a history of failed foreign policy that leads to devastation in its way because we have a short-sighted interest. I think we're seeing that play out in Pakistan. I think there's still a chance because it does have a strong middle class. It does have an educated middle class. It does have a strong legal system that does want to go back to a democratically elected system. That's the history and tradition. I think we have to be very careful there. Because that's a dangerous place. That country
I do think the president is doing the right thing, but let's engage in conversation. Let's talk.
Is that the move?
Yes, that's the telephone. I think that that's where we work with other members. And we try to ensure that the infrastructure is right behind. Yeah, that there is some presence, a little bit of presence.
It's not.
Could you create a vacuum? But I think, you know, democracy grows from within. Democracy is not mandated and imposed on anyone. It grows organically. So now let's go further on. I think we're seeing something remarkable happening in Iran. And we're standing on the sideline, right? It's growing organically because people are pissed. And I think we'll see this play out without interference. And I think it will create something very stable because it grew from within. That's how this country was formed. It grew from within. And I think that is where democracy comes from. So, sorry, was that too professorial?
No. Perfect. Would you pour an investigation into, you know, the wiretapping and all that?
Yeah.
Things that happened with torture?
So my instinctive response is yes.
Okay.
Because I feel logical about it. My therapeutic response is, will that help move our country forward? Or will it rip the band-aid off and keep us in this divisiveness? And I don't know the answer to that question. If we want to be a lawful country, then we probably need to know those answers. Because if we don't look at that, history will repeat itself. And I do believe that's what our culture is doing. I also am very impressed with our culture. I don't always agree with things because I have my curiosity. I want to know what he's saying and finding. But I have to trust that if he finds something that is not in the best interest of moving this country forward, that he's going to hold that back. If, on the other hand, we need to safeguard the future of this country, we need to put stopgaps, and you uncover something that is a travesty, I think then you have to move that forward and say, let's talk about this. And if laws were broken, you know, you have to prosecute. So. Otherwise, you send a very bad message to the rest. I mean, government has to lead by example, right? And unfortunately, you know, you've been leading by a bad example, a very self-centered example, which, you know, I think the public's been following, unfortunately. So it's 8 o'clock. I want to be respectful of time. So I want to thank all of you guys for coming out and sharing time with me. The way we win this election is by everyone being engaged, involved. Everyone going to their neighborhood, and they're having neighborhood night out, wearing their sticker, saying, hey, have you heard about, you know, this campaign? Are you guys registered to vote? And when they say, well, I don't want to register because I don't want to have jury duty. You know what?
That's part of community service is jury duty.
Absolutely. Right. Well, and if they have a driver's license,
What I wanted to say is being passed out. We're having a voter registration canvas this Saturday. We're meeting up at Laguna Creek High School. We're going to start at 9 and go till 1. It's not supposed to be a very warm day. So, you know, and getting to your question earlier, Trina, about how we're going to beat Lundgren, is what Army said, is through hard work. We did it on the Obama campaign. A lot of us were involved for 2 years on that thing. And we know the reason that we got it done was because, excuse me, we all worked our asses off.
and that's how we're going to get on the elected, and that's why we're already starting the field campaign, is because we have to. There is no choice. We have a candidate who wants to talk to as many voters as he can, and who should, and that's why I came on board, is because I liked his attitude of inclusiveness. I liked that he wants to reach out and include so many people and really be a representative, a public service, not just another, a public servant, not just another politician. So I really encourage you guys to get involved. I know you guys are all just awesome, incredible, wonderful people.
Could I say one thing just from my standpoint, too, that, you know, everybody always talks about the value of early money in a campaign, and it certainly is true, but there's also incredible value to, you know, early effort on the part of volunteers in a campaign. There's a lot of groundwork that needs to be laid and a lot of stuff that needs to be done very early on. And so I would really encourage you to reach out to your friends and, you know, really try to mobilize. I think the point about the healthcare thing is right on spot and all that. But we really do need to mobilize people early if we're going to win, you know, this congressional
district. Kathy, you have something?
Just a question, logistics. I couldn't be there at 9 a.m. I have a Saturday morning commitment. Is there a way to meet up with you in the middle?
I will be there from 9 to 1 in that parking lot.
Oh, okay.
So if you can come at 10, if you can come at 11.
Perfect.
If you
sure
can come at 9 but have to leave at 10:30. Any portion of time in there that you can give, please, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Can I just make a quick pitch? Because I'd be against medicine to be the salesperson of this campaign, another salesperson of this campaign. I had the opportunity to work with Jan Brown for a year on a healthcare campaign during the time that her husband Charlie was running for a neighboring congressional.
What's your name?
Eric Wooten.
Oh, you worked with my daughter.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I told her, well, months before the general, I said, do you have a good recount team? And I said, because it's going to be close. I didn't know how close it was going to be, but I knew it was going to be close. I said, every vote's going to count. It's going to be a scrapping, fighting, down to the wire thing. And it was. It was, whatever, 300 votes. And this is going to be a scrapping, fighting thing, except we're going to be on the other side of it. The thing is, though, it's every mile walked, every call made, every dollar given, that's how we're going to win this thing. And you can't say that, well, I only can afford to give $5. It's not going to make a difference. It's going to make a difference. Trust me. We'll use the five. It'll make a difference. I can only give an hour of my life to do phone calls. Well, that's great. You've just touched 20 voters. You know, those 20 voters are going to make a difference. You know, I can only go out one time the whole year. I have one day at home, and you can give us 2 hours of time. It's going to make a difference. It will. I promise you it'll make a difference. And the thing is, every point of strength that Dr. Barrett shows early makes his life that much more likely that he's going to be in Congress later. He outraised a sitting Republican congressman by a lot and not taking PAC money. And he was one of the best fundraisers in the whole country. But the naysaying class in D.C., the first thing they said is, well, he doesn't have a lot of small donors. So if you guys at South Point can go online and get $5 each, we can take care of that thing. If they say, well, you know, it's Republican district and you're not going to have another, we come back and we show, hey, look, we already registered 300 new Democrats. Well, that complaint's off. But you know what I mean? That this is doable, but the only way it's doable is, again, in chemistry, you know what I'm saying? What Mark's saying, it's going to take, you know, every scrap. But I have no doubt that if that happens, Dr. Barrett is going to be the congressman.
It gets me fired up and ready to go. I see a lot of parallels to the early stages of the Obama campaign with the Bobby's campaign. You're going to get a lot of people on this canvas Saturday going, Dr. Who?
Sorry?
Who's that? You got the same thing when you first started going out into Obama campaign. This is Barack Obama. You know, everyone knew who Hillary was. Everyone knows who Lundgren is. Everyone knows who the other two Democrats are kind of being floated out there to run in the primary. It's all up to us to get Dr. Barrett out there, his name out there, introduce him to them. And once once that happens, that momentum starts, and people start going, oh, man, the guy has this, or the doctor, oh, you see that center. You know, they're hurt with Obama, oh, yeah, he's a great senator from Illinois, he wants to do this. You know, so that's exciting. I see a lot of parallels between the campaign and also the candidates. You know, sons of immigrants, mm-hmm. son of an immigrant. You know, person of color. And they come from backgrounds, professional backgrounds, that they started, you know, middle class and worked their butts off and achieved greatness, but now want to give back, become that, you know, that change agent. So that's my own.
Now I get to go lucky proper in a political circle to give Ami the last word.
Yes.
yeah, what's overwhelming? And I think Rock talks about this a lot as well, is you know, how humbling it is that people invite into their lives, that people tell you where they're hurting, where they're suffering. They're sharing stories with you that are intimate stories. That is the whole point of service. That is the whole point I went into medicine, to try to heal things. Well, at a community level and at the country level, we've got to heal ourselves. And we know what ails us. We know the things that are tearing us apart. Yet we have to find the courage to let go of this system in order for what we know we can be, or what we know we were. And that is what we have to help empower people to believe in. And I think that's the inspiration that Obama tapped into. And we just got to continue that. Because the status quo is not an option. We know the status quo is leaving a lot of people behind. It's serving a small segment of the population. 90% of us live here down in the bottom third of wealth. 10% of the population has two-thirds of the wealth. They're living hidden. They're not aware of what's going on down here with 90% of us. We've got to rebuild that ladder and give people a chance. And that is going to take all of us articulating this, and that is going to, and you know, Mark touched on it. Money is not going to win this election. It's important. It gives us resources. It gives us ability. What is going to win this election is the number of people we can touch, the number of people we can empower, the number of people we can engage and get them to believe.